what I'd really like to know to start with is the name Pifaro. You know, if I'm correct, you used to be called the Philadelphia Renaissance Wind Band.
That's right.
And that's pretty self-explanatory, straightforward. And now you go by Pifaro. So I'm curious to know why the change, and I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about what is Pifaro.
Yes, Philadelphia Renaissance Wind Band. You're right. It localized us. It told people what we did. However, when we signed a recording contract with Deutsche Grammophon in 1994, they felt the name was too long and too localized. Forget the fact that the Philadelphia Orchestra does very well with the name. So we went through a process of trying to come up with another name and went through lots of options, some of them serious, some not so serious, and eventually came up with Pifaro. And Pifaro is an old Italian word, dates as early as probably the 15th, perhaps the 14th century, that simply means piper, and it can refer to a wind player. If you were a wind player in 15th century Italy, for instance, you would probably go by Stefano Pifaro, Stephen the wind player. And so it seemed to make sense, since all of us are wind players, and we play music of the 15th, 16th, and early 17th century, so Pifaro it became.
Hmm.
It's got a nice little onomatopoetic quality to it that we use in school shows as well, with a puff of air. You know, Pifaro is kind of fun.
Yeah. So tell me about what are the instruments in Pifaro, since you just said they're all wind instruments. What are the instruments that you use?
They're almost all wind instruments. We also have some string instruments, and we play percussion, but they are all copies of they're all copies of instruments that were a part of the official arsenal of the professional wind bands in the 15th, 16th, and early 17th century. And that included predominantly the early double reed instruments, which are we call now shawms, and they are the predecessors of the modern oboe and English horn family, and a double reed instrument called a dulcian or kirtle, and that's predecessor of the modern bassoon. And then those are put into an ensemble together with a wonderful instrument called the sacbut. In France and England, it was called the sacbut. Old French, sacbute, meant push-pull. And in Italy, it was called the trombone, big trumpet, and ever since called the trombone. So the combination of double reeds and brass was the main ensemble for these professional working musicians. And so we play those. We also play a variety of others, including recorders, some oddities that didn't survive the birth of the orchestra in the 17th century, the crumb horn, for instance, and things like Dussains and rackets and early flutes, little recorders that only have three holes, which we call three-hole pipes, and a variety of other wind instruments.
Hmm. Now, I have seen you perform a couple of times, and I noticed that you all, or most of you, seem to sort of trade on and off with many of these instruments. It doesn't seem like you have a sacbut specialist, for example.
We all tend to specialize a little bit, but it was the practice at the time for the wind players to play a variety of instruments. And in fact, when the boys, and they were all boys because women were not professional musicians in the same sense that the men were, but when the boys started in the guilds early on, they were instructed in a variety of different instruments, knowing that they would have to play in different circumstances. So that's the practice that we continue as well.
Okay, so you're a little kid, and the band lady comes to the classroom and says, "And what instrument would you like to play?" And you said, "Oh, I'd like to play the crumb horn." Probably not, huh?
Probably not.
So what was the instrument? How did you get into this? What were your early musical training?
I started on trumpet in the fifth grade and quickly moved. There were many trumpets at the time, popular instrument, and quickly moved in a couple of years to French horn and fell in love with French horn and played French horn for about 18 years. and was enticed when I was at the University of Pennsylvania doing graduate work to start playing recorder. And so I did, and that really opened up a new world of repertoire that I had never known before, playing French horn. The earliest repertoire we play was, of course, Mozart, and maybe a little late Baroque, but I simply did not know the Renaissance and medieval period literature at all. So once I started playing and found this repertoire and these instruments and realized that the life of a Renaissance musician is much different from a modern musician in a lot of ways, then I was pretty much bitten by the bug.
So what specifically, what instruments are your specialties?
I specialize in reeds, double reeds probably, okay, especially the dulcian, early bassoon, and shawm, but of course play all the others as well.
A lot of this music is very obscure, and so I'm curious to know where in the world you come up with the repertory. You know, how do you find it?
Well, that's one of the exciting things that I alluded to in saying that it's a different life than a modern performer who, for instance, plays in an orchestra and sits down at his stand, and there's the music, his or her stand, and the music is right there waiting. It's all marked. No note is left unexpressed. You know what you're going to play and how you're going to play it. For us, it's much more of an archaeological project, unearthing the music to begin with, which even 20 years ago was a much more difficult job than it is today. So much has been done in this area. More publications, more things are made available. The library at the University of Pennsylvania has been very good at buying just about everything that has been published over the past 20, 30 years and has a wonderful collection. We get a lot of our music from the original sources and make our own editions of the modern editions of the original manuscripts or printed sources, however it might have survived. And of course, there's no marking. There's no indication of what should play a piece of music. So we have free rein to score the music as we see fit. And so we'll have reading sessions and read a stack of music and decide what works, what tickles our fancy, what seems to be, quote, great music, and put a program together that way.
Now, I know with several of your recordings, you have grouped together music by country or by region, and I'm wondering whether that is just a way of making it sort of easy for a listener or a layman to sort of wrap their brain around it, or whether there is maybe some significance in the way musicians from a particular region in that era might actually approach the music that would be different from, you know, for example, your French Renaissance a collection as opposed to the Flemish or or German or Spanish. Is there some different approach that those musicians would have taken?
I think that especially in the polyphony, the official sacred music of the day in the late 15th to 16th century, it was a pretty international language. And though there would be local differences, they might be a little more obscure, a little harder to define than the fact that it belonged to this category of mass or motet. So in that regard, it doesn't make a lot of difference to focus on a region or a country or a composer. But we found in the past that, and part of our job is to play all sorts of music, from the sacred art music to popular music of the day to rustic dances. We try to do a broad swath of types and kinds of music, and I think it helps to keep the energy and the life of a recording or a concert going. You know, it's true that a modern, an orchestral, for instance, concert may be made up of four pieces, whereas a Renaissance concert may be made up of 30 pieces. They're all short pieces. So there has to be some organizing principle that makes sense, that pulls all of this together. And we often find that country or regional combinations of pieces works very well for us and for the listeners.
Mm-hmm. And you made some mention of school performances and the the name and all that. I'm curious to know the kind of outreach and school performances you do for young people and kind of how you see your mission in that area.
It clearly is a large part of our mission. We don't do as much as we'd like to do. It's been very difficult for schools. Money is very scarce. But here in Philadelphia, we do a number anywhere from 8 to 10 to 12 shows per year. And on tour, we almost always try to ally an outreach program. And in some cities, we've been returning regularly, and we'll spend a week in a school and work with the students and teach them Renaissance dancing, work with their own instruments, and play a concert, let them try some of our instruments, and just children find it fascinating, the sounds and the shapes of the instruments and instrumental colors. It's a lot of fun.
Some of them are very humorous sounding instruments.
They can be. They can be.
Tell me about the instruments themselves that you play. Are you playing actual ancient instruments? Are you playing reproductions? Are you playing a little of each?
All of our instruments are reproductions. And over the course of the last 25 years, I guess, it's been, I hate to think how many instruments we've gone through, because the process of creating good professional quality reproductions is only now beginning to emerge. We work directly with a number of instrument makers, both here in the U.S. and in Europe, in commissioning works, commissioning copies of surviving instruments. To play a wooden wind instrument is the process of destroying it. So as you wet it with your breath and it gets wet, dries out, et cetera, so any surviving instrument is kept as a model for reproduction rather than played. And there aren't that many actually surviving from the Renaissance in any case. We play bagpipes, and there are no surviving bagpipes, so that the makers simply reproduce them by virtue of what they see in the iconography and paintings and sculpture and that sort of thing.
You mentioned that the group sort of took shape in the early 80s, 82, I think. And that was sort of early to mid, revival, if you will. It was like 50s, 60s, 70s was when Baroque music and Renaissance music, early music, were really being ignited. And as it's come into its maturity, really, the ensembles, the recordings that are available and all, I'm curious to know how, and since you've sort of been right there on the cutting edge, I'm curious to know how you see it has changed. How is it different now than even in 82 or even before that?
It's changed so much. When we got involved in the early 80s, there was a lot of course, string playing, harpsichord, keyboard playing had already reached a high level of quality and even perhaps Baroque wind playing. Renaissance wind playing, however, was still treated as a novelty. And the instruments that were available, the reproductions that were available, were just barely playable. And so we set out at the very beginning to, as one of our main goals, was to bring Renaissance playing up to the quality, Renaissance wind playing, up to the quality of what the string players were doing and the keyboardists and the Baroque wind players. And so the course of the 20 years after that has brought us a long way. And as I said, we've always buying instruments and trying to improve the quality of our collection. And we're all involved in teaching, and it's very nice to see that there are, and I teach at Temple University, there are a whole generation of young wind players coming along, and we teach at various festivals, Madison Early Music Festival in Madison, Wisconsin, especially. And so it's just a whole new day. And I think one particular aspect, which is a little arcane but might be interesting, that Renaissance wind players played at a higher pitch level than we do today. We think of A440 as the standard. And consequently, all the reproductions were stretched to play at A440. But we realized about 10 years ago that if we're going to pursue this professionally, then we have to start playing at the pitch level that the Renaissance players did. And so now we're playing at about A463, which is roughly a half step higher than modern pitch. And that's made for a whole new day, too. The instruments are completely different. They feel different. They sound different. And we're one of only about two ensembles in the country that do that yet. And so there's work to be done. And we're bringing young players along and heading them in this direction.
Well, now that's really, this is news to me about the higher pitch, because, of course, one always thinks of Baroque instruments and playing at a lower pitch.
That's right.
So where is the discrepancy? Where did that happen?
This is still a part of the scholarly debate, but when one looks at the collection of surviving Renaissance instruments, they all play anywhere from a half step to even more than a whole step higher than our modern counterparts. There were two pitch levels called different terms in different places. One was choir tone and one was chamber tone, quartone and camertone. And wind instruments seem to work better at a higher pitch, and the strings seem to work better at a lower pitch. And consequently, even in the Renaissance, a lot of the stringed instruments, the viola da gamba family, for instance, strung at a lower pitch level, and the wind players were playing. And it may have been roughly at a pitch apart, a step apart, so that it wouldn't be too, one would be playing in the key of F and the other group would be playing in the key of G, but sounding at the same pitch. And as we moved into the Baroque period, then, because the strings became the real basis of the orchestra, then there was the whole revival in France that almost recreated all the wind instruments at a lower pitch, at a, what we think of as Baroque pitch now.
Interesting. Okay, so when the recorders and shams and all that, when they're all packed up and the reference books are all closed, what are you listening to? What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Oh, that's very interesting. I would say that I listen to more jazz than anything else. But I still don't. I still go back to listen to 60s and 70s from my youth.
Oh, you know? Such as?
Oh, you know, Motown kind of things. And I even when I was young, however, I mostly listened to classical music. There are times when I just prefer listening to nothing, listening to the quiet.
You've got a 25th anniversary for this group coming up, don't you?
That's true.
What does that mean? What's the future for P4O for this 25th anniversary coming up?
We are thinking in terms now, since we have been so much a two-person generated ensemble. Joan and I have been the leaders since 89, and we've been kind of the stable element. We're in fact, have a strategic planning meeting with our board tomorrow asking this very question. What's the future look like and how do we go there? The question of whether P4O survives Joan and myself is one that's coming up. And it's the kind of question that happens about the 25th year or so. We have a lot that we want to do. We have several recording projects in mind. And, of course, the recording world has changed so much now. How do we participate in that world now too? And there is so much repertoire to play out there that we're looking ahead to at least 3 or 4 years of projects that are already laid out for us. And
mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.